Accession number 12910, Reel 6.
Mr. Imre, Reel 6.
I think before I embark on the Gold Coast, I would like to say something about the head of the Palestine police, RGB Spicer, Roy Spicer. He was, to my mind, a very great man indeed. And although he may not have been the doyen of the colonial police service, who I think has to be a man called Sir Herbert Dowbiggin of Ceylon, Spicer really did more in very many ways for the colonial police service than anybody. He had served under Dowbiggin in Ceylon as a young cadet. From there, after service in the Great War, when he was badly wounded and badly gassed, he went back to Ceylon to begin with, and then he went to command the police of Kenya, where he, now called Kenya, of course, where he reorganized that force enormously. And when I got to Kenya, many, many years later, there were still people there who remembered Spicer and remembered his very considerable drive and reorganizing ability. Anyway, from there, he was in Kenya. He went to Kenya in 1925. Then in 1931, following the riots in Palestine, his former chief, Dowbiggin, was sent by that time he'd retired, but he was sent in an investigating capacity and a reporting capacity to Palestine, where he reported very, very comprehensively on the Palestine police. And as a result of that, Spicer was offered and accepted to become chief of police in Palestine. So there he went from Kenya to Palestine, arriving there at the end of 31. He found there, when he arrived, a quasi-military police force with very little pretensions to be a civil police force. He started immediately to put this right, and he created, certainly during the years that I were there, from 32 to 35, he was in the process then of building this civil police force. And one can say, without any fear of contradiction, that we had under Spicer a very forcible complete training in what a civil policeman should be. Spicer was in no doubt about what he wanted. He knew every policeman's job better than they knew it themselves. He made many, many enemies, because a man of that dynamic drive nearly always does. But he was very, very thorough. He knew every man. He had a prodigious memory for faces and for names. And he seemed to be everywhere. He was, to give an example, I was one night at about 3 o'clock in the morning down in Ramleh. I was on station orderly duty in the police station, and I was on my own there, and the door opened, and in walked Spicer, Roy Spicer, wearing his kalpak, which was the headgear, the old Turkish headgear, which officers of the Palestine police then wore, and he had a police greatcoat over his dinner jacket. He'd obviously been out to dinner somewhere, to a party. And he came in, and he started questioning me about what had happened in the station that night, what the patrol system was that night, where the patrols were, and everything about it. He knew the whole thing backwards. Fortunately, I had got everything in under control, and then he went out to have a look and try to find the patrols, which he did. But that's the kind of man he was. He was everywhere. If one was injured or ill in hospital, Spicer would always be there to see how the young man was getting on. He was a great sportsman. He was a very good performer at cricket. He mastered a pack of hounds down at Ramleigh and was always keen for any of us who had horses or could find horses to follow the hounds. He played polo down there, and he made arrangements for us all to have polo sticks and polo balls so that we could knock around on the polo field. He was always on the touchline at rugby football matches or soccer matches, and he was usually in the judge's seat at boxing contests. He was everywhere, and he even took part in our amateur dramatics up at Mount Scopus, the depot. So there you had a man who, in every phase of police work, was highly knowledgeable and was driving dynamically the entire time. Physically, he was very small. I often equate him, although I never met Field Marshal Lord Montgomery, I always equate him with Montgomery because they were both at St. Paul's School together at the same time. And so far as I can understand, they probably had the same characteristics. They were both small. They were both dynamic. They both knew their job absolutely backwards. And they both put it across. And they both had many enemies because of the way they worked. Spicer was always, it seemed to me, short of breath from having been gassed in War One. He must have been in pain quite frequently, I think, from wounds. And there's no doubt that he had a heart condition, which he didn't assist, probably, by the enormous amount of hard work he put in. He eventually died at the early age of, I think, about 57, because when he left Palestine, which he had to do because the colonial office pulled him out of it, there'd been several attempts on his life, and they pulled him out of it, and he was given the job of Chief Constable of the Isle of Wight. And I believe I'm right in saying that it was judging a dog show in the Isle of Wight that he suddenly collapsed and died at the age of 57.
You talked about making enemies, but does that necessarily have to be the case if you're dynamic, or did it depend on manner?
I think the answer to that is that Spicer was not always tactful. I think he had his favourites, without any doubt at all, he would there would be utterances which might have been left unsaid from time to time. He drove his senior officers to distraction sometimes, because when he arrived on the scene, a number of them had never known what real policing was. He got rid of one or two that wouldn't learn. But on the whole, he was. There were a cabal of officers, senior officers there, who were absolutely splendid in every way. They rallied round Spicer, particularly from his deputy. He had tremendous help. Alan Saunders was his deputy, and I doubt very much whether he could have forged this police force as he did without Alan Saunders and this cabal of very fine officers who did give him total loyalty. But in the first place, I doubt very much whether they were policemen such as Spicer wanted. He taught them. But in answer to your question, I think that Tact was not Roy Spicer's middle name.
But what did one have to do or be in order to be a favourite of his?
You had to learn under him. You had to show that you were keen to learn. I was myself. I remember I arrived up at the depot with my squad of recruits in April or May 32. We were taken down to police headquarters in the Russian building in Jerusalem. And there we were lined up outside Spicer's office in the passage. And one by one, individually, we were marched in front of Spicer. And Spicer looked me up and down. And there he was sitting there, perfectly turned out, immaculate as he always was, this little man. And he said to me, "Are you proposing to stay in the police, or are you simply making use of the police during this time of recession, like quite a number of people are?" So I said, "I hope, sir, to learn how to be a policeman." And that pleased him. And he said, "I understand you play cricket." He said, "I shall expect you to see you on the cricket field in due course. And now, goodbye." And, of course, one learnt that when RGB, as one always used to call him, that's Roy RGB Spicer, when RGB expected something, it always had to happen, without any doubt at all. If it didn't happen, you were no use to him.
What do you think was his motivation? Was it service or personal ambition or what?
I think he simply had the police idea, as he used to talk about. I think he'd had it rammed into him by Dowbiggin in Ceylon in the first place. And I think this had taken root with him, and it was his own personal dynamism. No, I don't think there was... I don't believe Spicer was necessarily driven by ambition. I think he had this tremendous driving interest in policing. He used to talk to us about early policing in Britain. And I've heard him talk in public, and he's talked sometimes to me during cricket matches or during amateur dramatics up at Mount Scopus. So I would... and very many of Spicer's ideas were later taken by people who became commissioned out of the Palestine police to many other territories. And there's no doubt that Dowbiggin-ism, or if you like, Spicerism, spread throughout the whole colonial empire in the police forces.
Could I ask you a general question about the mandate and the attitude of Palestine policemen towards the mandate? was there any sense of idealism towards a mandate, or was there any cynicism towards it? What was the general attitude towards the existence of a British mandate in Palestine?
Well, before I try to answer that more particularly, I'd have to say to you that most Palestine policemen, when I got there, were not men of particularly advanced education. They were men from the Brigade of Guards, rankers from the Brigade of Guards. They were black and tans from Ireland. They were ex-RIC, and they were troopers from British cavalry regiments. So they were there really on a continuance of their army service. So by and large, let us say that they were there to obey orders. They enjoyed the country, but I doubt whether they were great and powerful thinkers on political stuff, from which the mandate originated. There were a nucleus of us who came who had read how the mandate originated, and I think there were many of us who felt that we were really sitting on a knife edge, because it seemed to us, and I had been one of those who had read, it seemed to us that there had been three treaties, arrangements, obligations made by Britain, all of which counterblasted each other. I'm talking about the Hussein Agreement, McMahon-Hussein Agreement, one. I'm talking about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, two. I'm talking about the Balfour Declaration, three. And each of those seemed to, in fact they did, without any doubt, countermand each other. And Britain, it seemed to those of us who did think about it, seemed to have got itself into a muddle. And the mandate was clearly on a knife edge, because you had two very persuasive leaders. There was Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti, propagating Arab affairs, and there was Dr. Weizmann on the Jewish side. And it seemed then, even then, as it certainly seems in retrospect, that in response to requests and to approaches by those two leaders, Whitehall blew hot and cold on the subject of Jewish immigration. So that, I think, I hope, answers to some extent your question.
Now, perhaps we can move on to the Gold Coast, if you feel ready to tackle that now, please.
Yes. Well, I arrived in the Gold Coast in about May, I think, the end of May 1935. I had come from what I considered, and what undoubtedly was, a professional police force. Arriving in the Gold Coast, I found something rather different. But before I talk more about the police force itself, I would say that the Inspector General, the Chief of Police of the Gold Coast, was, again, a very remarkable man. His name was Colonel Bamford. He was not a policeman. He had been a soldier. But he was a very formidable figure. And he had created a very, very good esprit de corps on the Gold Coast out of very little. He was a very, very fine leader and figurehead of that force. And one could possibly say that he was the most outstanding figure in West Africa at that time. And I say that having thought about it quite a lot. He was formidable to meet. He didn't speak quickly. He had a chest full of medals. He was inclined to look at one quizzically, and to be perhaps fairly Olympian, but he had a very humane outlook. I became a complete fan of his. I thought he was. I felt that I was very privileged, once again privileged, to have served under a real leader in Colonel Bamford.
How did he compare with Spicer?
He compared, the two men were totally different. Bamford was a large man, essentially a soldier. He had served in South Africa. I think he'd gone there originally just after the turn of the century, and he'd served in the Cape Mounted Rifles as a trooper. And he'd served throughout the Great War and with the South African Brigade, and had been badly wounded at Delville Wood. And after the war, he'd been sent as Commissioner of Police to Malta. And I think he'd there met Lord Ironside, because the two of them knew each other very well and were friends. And he'd also met a known Plumer, Lord Plumer. From Malta, he had been sent as chief of the Northern Territories Constabulary in the Gold Coast, what was the Gold Coast. And that was the whole of the north of that country, the Gold Coast. But then at some stage later on, I think probably about 1925 or 26, the constabulary were amalgamated with the Gold Coast Police, and Bamford had become chief of the whole lot, chief of the whole the police of the whole territory. And there's no doubt that police buildings in the Gold Coast were superior to those of many other territories. Certainly they were better than the Palestine ones, and I can say from later experience they're much better than the Nigeria ones, Sierra Leone as well, and Kenya. So I would say that Bamford, through Bamford's drive and personality, he had managed to get enough money out of the Gold Coast government to set up the police of that territory in a way that was better than many other territories. The clothing of the men was always good. They were smart, spick and span, and alert. And somehow or other, there was a snap about the Gold Coast police, which was better than I experienced later in either Kenya or Nigeria, where I went right at the end on contract. Certainly much better than Nigeria, and I think better than Kenya too. It was a snap and a sense of alert. There was an alert atmosphere about them. And they were well turned out always. Now, under Bamford, there were only 35 officers in the Gold Coast Police at that time, and most of them were ex-army men. Many of them were decorated, well decorated, but they weren't policemen. There was a small cadre of them who were, who had been in other forces, but by and large, they were not. They were not policemen. They'd been soldiers, and knew very little about policing. And Bamford himself, of course, was essentially a soldier. He was a great administrator, but he wasn't a policeman. But here and there, there were policemen. We had, I'm thinking at the moment, of five men, one of whom I shall name. His name was Tottenham, Rex Tottenham. And he was possibly the most experienced, among the most experienced policemen I ever met. He was a wonderful man with a tremendous sense of humour. He'd served in a total, I think, of five forces. And he was, out and away, the most experienced policeman in the Gold Coast, probably in West Africa, the whole of West Africa. But there were another four, all of whom had served in other forces, and they knew the police job thoroughly. And they must have been a great source of help to Bamford, who, as I've said, wasn't a policeman himself.
So, on arrival, what kind of duties were you allocated?
Well, I was simply... there was... my first superintendent was a policeman. He was one of the five I've mentioned. And I was simply an assistant to him. But I very soon realised that, on the whole, I'd come to... By contrast with Palestine, I'd come to an amateur force. We spent far too much time sitting at desks doing paperwork. We had, in the Gold Coast, the police were responsible for all kinds of extraneous duties. Licensing, immigration, certain railway duties, and guards for all sorts of... We had to provide guards for all sorts of government institutions.